You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out door.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. And you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Have a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce. Potatoes,
yeah. I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Thanks for joining us tonight. Last Sunday, not long after Ted Kennedy's burial near his brothers Jack and Bobby, Sheila Lukens died at home in Manhattan. Like Senator Kennedy, Sheila Lukens lost a battle with brain cancer. Everyone who heard this news and recognized the name thought immediately of the Silver Palette Cookbook, a cookbook that is now in the Cookbook Hall of Fame and was as important as any other book about food published in the 1980s. Sheila Lukens and her partner and co-author, Julie Rosso, were among those who not only chronicled the transformation of how we eat and cook in America, they helped shape how we eat today. And although the Silver Palette was a New York institution, the scope of the book embraced the land from coast to coast with such dishes as gravlax, ceviche and steak tartare, to raspberry chicken, pasta primavera, and chocolate mousse, all put within reach of the home cook by the tender tutelage of Julie and Sheila. Last winter, Sheila Lukens stopped by Mouthful during a book tour for her book 10. We'll hear from her in just a bit, but first, we were able to catch up with Julie Rosso at her home in Michigan just a few days after she had returned from Sheila's Manhattan Memorial. Welcome to Mouthful, and thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Well, it's delightful to be with you.
And you're there in Michigan at the inn that you operate.
I'm actually at my house, which is on Lake Michigan.
Ah, and the inn is Wickwood Inn, right?
It is Wickwood Inn.
And how long have you had the inn?
19 years.
Wow.
My time flies when you're having fun.
It really does. Well, first of all, I really would like to extend our condolences for the loss of Sheila Lukens. I know she was a longtime friend, colleague, collaborator, and together, the two of you with the Silver Palette really changed the food world.
Well, that's kind of you to say. I must say it's been very sad the last couple of weeks, and also filled with millions of memories of very, very happy times. So it's been very paradoxical. I'm in emotions.
Oh, yeah, of course. And we were lucky here on Mouthful to be able to speak with Sheila in person when she was on tour for her book last December.
Mm-hmm.
So she was here in the studio with us, and we're going to be hearing that interview in a little bit. But first, we wanted to talk to you and really catch up with you. Sheila's been a little bit more public in the last number of years than you have.
Uh-huh.
But together with that, especially that first book, which came, the Silver Palette Cookbook that came out in 1977, I was looking at it, and in the opening paragraphs, it just gave me chills. It's absolutely prescient. You talk about the passion that the two of you had for food, and you talk about this feeling, the certainty you have that this is going to be one of the most exhilarating culinary eras in America. And I think you two wrote that in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And my question now is, as you look back on the moment that brought this book, that birthed this book, and gave you that feeling, how does it feel to really realize how very right you were?
Well, first of all, I have big tears in my eyes. So, It's just been an amazing journey. I think that when we revived the Silver Palette cookbook a couple of years ago for the 25th anniversary, I think that's when it all sort of hit me full force of exactly what had happened in this country. Because when the manuscript was delivered to my house and our editor said, just change the tenses, Jewel. You don't own the store anymore, so you can't say we do this every day, we do that every day. Just change the tenses. And I started to read it, and it said things like, well, there's no good bread in America. You must go into your kitchen and make these breads. And then it continued to talk about French cheeses. It was just dated because so much has happened in this country as far as food's concerned that I ended up having to rewrite the entire book.
But, you know, I can see how that element of the availability of certain things is dated. But one thing that I felt as I looked through my terribly battered copy of the initial printing is the book itself, the recipes, even the drawings, they don't feel dated. They feel very immediate. They feel very much like any of this is on our tables at any given time right now.
Right now. You're absolutely right. Well, because we always cooked with fresh ingredients. Now, when we wrote that book, arugula wasn't in every supermarket. And it was a very rare occurrence, even in New York City. Finding dill down the street at the greengrocer's was an occasion. Even Italian parsley wasn't a regular occurrence.
Yeah, I remember that.
But we, you know, we sought those things out. I remember going to the Union Square Market almost the second time it was open and talking to the founder, Barry Benepe, and begging him for this and that. And so we cooked with all those ingredients. I feel as though I spent the first 5 years that the book was published explaining what arugula was in this country. But little by little, those things became available. First, I always feel as though first there was sort of a barren land. Then we had everything in every season, you know, all the time. And it became sort of tasteless. And now we've gone through this cycle of quality and organic and really going back to the seasons the way I was brought up and shopping at farmers markets. So we've sort of come full cycle to be very quality conscious and very taste conscious. First and foremost comes taste. And so I think so that's the ebb and flow of what's happened. And so while lots of things are very much the same as when we wrote the book, it all is also different. Does that make any sense?
That makes total sense. And I think it's a really astute observation. I think you're completely right that going from, I remember searching endlessly for arugula, and then suddenly anything was available at any time of year. I remember the first time apricots appeared in my market in January, I almost cried because I want them to remind me of summer. And we are getting back to some degree, especially with the huge sustainability movement and that look of not spending tons and tons of gas and fuel to transport things. We're getting more back to that seasonal taste. And of course, that's when things taste good. Apricot doesn't taste good in January. It tastes good in June.
And raspberries don't taste particularly good in February. And when you taste a raspberry, I mean, I have a counter full of fresh raspberries right now, and they're just glorious things, particularly if they're being coddled by an organic farmer who's just, you know, the good soil, and they're just doing everything right. And then you say, oh, my goodness, that's what a raspberry is supposed to taste like.
Exactly.
But
and
you
pick it and you buy it from the farmer who's picked it a couple hours before, you know, you get to take it home and enjoy it.
And you come to trust that farmer, and that sets a whole new standard for your raspberries or your corn or your arugula or whatever it is. And that's what you want all the time. I was just in New York a couple of days ago, of course, for Sheila's memorial service, and went to the Union Square Market again, and I was just overwhelmed with the goodness that was everywhere. And you have that in California.
We do. And one of the things that struck me and still strikes me about the Silver Palette Cookbook, because I was a young budding professional, food professional at the time the book came out, and it was probably the book that influenced me as much as any other. And as I went back and looked at it this morning, I was realizing so much of who I became as a cook, it is to be found in the book. But what strikes me is it took place in New York. And for me, raspberry chicken makes so much sense because I'm here in Sonoma County. Back then when the book came out, we had a farm. Kozlowski Farms was growing the most delicious raspberries. A few years later, we were starting to get the country's first free-range chickens. So there were all these natural combinations of things that just made sense here where I was. And then I look and it's like, oh my goodness, it's all in this book that to me is also the heart of New York. So I was going to ask you next about those influences. The book does feel very New York, but it also has sort of woven through it some French influences, the chicken Dijonnaise, for example, the steak tartare. But also, I mean, arugula, you think of California. So how did those influences inform those early years?
Well, I did grow up in Michigan, and my father had been raised on a farm, and we always had a huge farm, not at our house in Kalamazoo, but at a lodge that we had up in northern Michigan. And so, you know, every Memorial Day weekend, we'd plant the garden. So that I knew from my soul. When we got to New York, I mean, it was still a sense of discovery. Sheila had traveled. She'd lived in London. She'd traveled widely. I'd done the grand tour when I was in college and been to, by the time I met Sheil, probably have been to Europe 15 or 20 times and the Caribbean and all of that. So many travels, much eating, just totally obsessed with food and discovery. And I think that it was sort of that melding of the two of us that made us, I always think, an insatiable curiosity, and that's what people in the food business have. I know I have it. You can do something, you know, tried and true that you've done 15 times, but it can be different every time, and that's the joy of cooking, no pun intended, the same thing can be different simply because you don't have an ingredient or you have an abundance of something else in the kitchen that you want to just toss in and it seems to make sense to you at the time. So that's the fun of the whole thing. But we always cooked with real food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was never, my mom, was a bride of the 50s, and she would, or I guess in the 40s, and it was boxes and cans and frozen things. By the time it got to my generation, we were busy cooking with real food.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what spawned the cookbook, which was the Silver Palette itself. The store was, if I have it right, it was 165 square feet.
Yes.
That's like about the size of most apartment bathrooms, I think.
It was very tiny. In fact, I drove by it for the first time this past week, and the door was open, and I was just aghast at how small it was. I don't know how we did it. I don't know how we put as much in it as we did, but it worked.
Now, did you actually cook there as well as sell
them? No.
I didn't think so.
Originally, when we started, yeah, it was going to be the best of New York, and we were going to buy in a lot of things and cheeses and pâtés and sausages and breads and then just make a few things. And Sheila was going to cook in her apartment, and then we were going to have a messenger deliver it from her apartment to the store. I had many real jobs. I was going to med school at Columbia. I had a business called Fashion Testing from my marketing fashion.
Wait,
days.
You were going to med school? And you were involved.
It's called med school for the aged.
And you were also involved, I know, in fashion and advertising.
I had worked in the fashion business and in advertising for many years. And so the Silver Palette was, you know, an idea I had simply because I lived in 68th and Madison and everything closed at 5 o'clock. And I thought, I can't be the only person who feels like an orphan because I can't, my grocery store is four blocks away. There should be something, someplace that I can get something that's ready-made and be able to eat. And so that was the genesis of the idea. And we opened on Columbus Avenue to sort of open out of town before we took it to Madison Avenue. We just never got to Madison Avenue.
What was it like immediately? I know that you opened in that summer of 77. Wait.
Summer of 77.
That's right. Summer of 77 and during a heat wave, right?
Yes. 103 degrees.
But how did people find you? Did you just open the door and whisper? Did you do any early advertising?
Well, a couple of things happened just in the course of events. We were renovating this little TV repair shop, and we had an architect, Lance Brown, who was working on it. And as I said, I had a real job, but I really wanted to be involved in the physical, you know, ness of the store. And so there was a door, old door, that had like 40 years of paint on it, and I used to sit on Columbus Avenue and sand it. Like an idiot, you know, people don't do that in New York, but I did anyway. And people would go by and say, what are you opening there? And I'd tell them what the store was going to be about. And then it sort of became an idea that we needed somebody to make chocolate chip cookies. We wanted to have big 6-inch or 8-inch chocolate chip cookies in those old-fashioned apothecary, those anchor hocking jars. Remember those?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, and we wanted them to be the size of that. We wanted to sell them for a dollar. Well, Sheil didn't care for sweets or baked goods, and I have a major sweet tooth. But as I say, I had these other responsibilities. I mean, I could muster making brownies early in the morning before I went to work and doing gravlax on my kitchen counter, but I just couldn't take on chocolate chip cookies. So we had a chocolate chip cookie contest for the neighborhood to see who could bake the best chocolate chip cookies. Well, lo and behold, the guy who won the chocolate chip cookie contest was the advertising director of Saks Fifth Avenue. He had no intention of quitting his day job to make chocolate chip cookies for us. So he gave us his recipe, and we had another gal who ran the brownie contest, and she made the baked goods for a while. Until we finally, the health department finally said after about a year and a half, girls, you cannot run a business this way.
I was wondering about that. Yeah, I was wondering, you know, these days, certainly in Sonoma County in California, you would just get closed down in a heartbeat if they found out you were cooking in apartments.
They'd never seen anything like us.
Yeah.
The sales tax people used to, you know, they used to stand in our store and they'd say, well, now if you don't stuff the chicken, then you don't have to charge sales tax. But if you do stuff the chicken, then you'd have to charge sales tax. I mean, they didn't know what to do with us.
Oh, my gosh. You must have had to have a binder to figure out what to, you know, to note everything.
Very confusing.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, back to the first day, because we had had this contest and I was sanding the door, by the time we opened, the neighborhood was abuzz, unbeknownst to us. We didn't know. And simultaneously, there was a concert in Central Park that night. So as soon as we opened the door, there were lines of people because they wanted to take their picnics to the park.
Oh, of course. That must have been terrifying on your first day.
It was totally terrifying because, of course, I'm standing behind the counter, and there's a little country French scale that I'd bought from Howard Kaplan that I thought was so charming. Well, by the time the first person says, I'd like a 3/4 of a pound of chicken salad, and you're multiplying because there was no computerized scale. It was a nightmare that first night. And the lines finally dribbled away because the concert started. But during the interim, the air conditioner had broken. So at the end of the night, we closed the door, and Sheil wasn't there. She had cooked, you know, during the day. The store was empty. There was no food left. We were exhausted. It was hotter than Hades. And It was just astounding to think, oh, my goodness, we've got to do this all again tomorrow.
And how long did you do it in just that way?
In the way without a kitchen?
Well, yeah, transporting from Sheila's apartment.
I think it was about a year and a half. Uh-huh. We had an auxiliary kitchen that we took over an apartment in this particular building that we ultimately built the kitchen in. But we used that just for storage for a while. But I remember the first Thanksgiving we had gotten a write-up by Mimi Sheridan about some of our pies, and my father was busy building shelves as the pies would come out of the oven. He had to build as fast as the pies needed to cool. I mean, it was just...
Wow.
if a business could have been started upside down and backwards, this was it.
Amazing, amazing. And then you expanded. And I'm a little unclear on when you and Sheila, I guess you sold the business?
We sold the business in 1986.
86, okay.
And then we had a two-year contract to stay on, and so we stayed until 88.
Stayed until 88. And it endures today as a brand, right?
Yes, very much
yes.
so.
And I know that those, when you started canning, the chutneys, that chocolate sauce that everyone loved so much, that was another huge leap for all of you, right? And was that when it really went national?
Well, yes, it did. We first closed the store right around Labor Day, and we turned it into the canning kitchen. And I think Shil was in Europe at that point. But we wanted to fill our shelves with our own products instead of just having to sell more chicken salad to buy somebody else's products to put on the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did that over the course of this week. And right away, no one noticed. I mean, I remember so clearly thinking that our customers would come in and be astounded with the shelves with all of our products on it. And instead, they were just glad that their chicken salad was back in business.
Uh-huh.
You know? But a little bit later on that fall, not long at all, Bird Tansky from Saks Fifth Avenue, the president of Saks, our good old advertising chocolate chip cookie contest winner, had mentioned to him that he should come up on Columbus Avenue and see what was going on because Saks had decided they wanted to be in the food business. So he came in and said, would we possibly consider going back into the canning kitchen and making products for Saks Fifth Avenue? And then within a couple of days, Gordon Siegel from Crate and Barrel also wandered up Columbus Avenue and asked me to go for coffee. And believe me, it was only after Gordon Siegel also asked that I was ready to admit to Sheil that we had to go back into the canning kitchen
uh-huh.
again.
Well, it really did just completely rock the world, this country anyway. I remember both giving and receiving Silver Palette products fairly early on for holidays. And I kind of remember eating, was there a caramel sauce?
Oh, a caramel pecan sauce, yeah.
Yes, I think I ate a jar with a spoon. I don't think I ever used it for anything.
Good.
Yes, it was outstanding. A little bit more now about the book. One of the things that I've always really enjoyed about the book, and I think everyone does, are the tips from the Silver Palette Notebook.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, is there a collection of Silver Palette Notebooks, notes that you all took during this amazing process?
Oh, no. Those were just things that we did.
That you did. Okay.
That we did.
But, I mean, did you write them down as you worked without knowing that a book was coming, or was it things that you compiled once you knew that you were working on the book?
Compiled once we knew that we were
okay.
working on the book. I started the book on Memorial Day weekend of 1981, it would be, and finished it on Labor Day weekend.
Wow. That's a lot of work.
And all the recipes had been just on, we used to call them cost-out cards.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no recipes. There were just lists of ingredients with, you know, basically how you make chicken salad or whatever. And so we had to convert. Sheil spent the summer drawing.
So the drawings are Sheila's drawings?
Those are all Sheila's drawings.
That was my next question. I love the drawings.
Yes, the drawings were magnificent. And Michael McLaughlin, who had been working behind the counter at the Silver Palette, took some of the recipes and would try and convert them, or took some of the cost-out cards and tried to write recipes. You know, none of us knew what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was just, and this was all done nights and weekends. I mean, we were still running a business. And then I'd write the book. That was the plan. And we'd sort of sit on a porch stoop and decide a layout of a page and how many recipes we thought could fit on a page. And then I'd, you know how many lines of copy I'd have to write. This is my old advertising background. And then I know how many lines of copy I had to write about a particular subject. And then we'd finish that double page spread and get on to the next.
Oh, interesting. That's an interesting way to do it. So you actually did it thinking graphically as you were working.
Well, we felt that we needed to because Sheila had to know what to draw.
Draw, and, of course.
You know, how complex, etc. Uh-huh. And I had to know how much to write. And I had run in-house ad agencies, and it was the only way I knew how to think. I mean, mm-hmm. we did not know how to write a book.
Yeah. That must be one of the reasons the book just feels so true and so much of a piece. And, I mean, I think your explanation really tells why. It's fascinating.
It was pretty funny. I mean, truly. I think I've often told the story about the copy editor writing a terrible note saying, "No, girls, no, you cannot possibly put that much garlic in the ratatouille."
And oh, right, just, I know. Yes.
It sent us right back to the kitchen to say, "Oh, what have we done?" And we like it that way, you know?
Yeah, and I think you were probably the first people, or at least the second, to put chicken with 40 cloves of garlic into a book. That was one of my immediate favorites. And yeah. I think John Harris of Book of Garlic fame did some of those really garlic exuberant recipes as well in the mid-70s.
I think one of the things that was tried and true is this: is we sort of Americanized, if you can say that, a lot of classical recipes from around the world, in that Americans like to sort of be blown away with mm-hmm. taste, or at least we did.
Especially at that time, I think.
Yeah, we like magnified flavors and wanted clean and clear flavors that you knew what you were eating. Subtlety sort of didn't exist in our vocabulary.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You know, we wanted to have the garlic hit us over the head.
Well, and you know, I guess I still want.
Yeah. People still say there's no such thing as too much garlic. Well, Julie, tell me, what is your life like now with the inn? Are you involved in the kitchen? Do you keep your hands, you know, into stirring and that sort of thing?
Well, I keep my hands in sort of all the pots. The inn is wonderful because you can, you know, one minute you can be talking to people, the next minute you can be testing a recipe, the next minute you can be decorating, the next minute I can be writing a newsletter. I have a garden behind our house. I swear my tomatoes are 12 feet high at this point. If they ever get green or red, it'll be a miracle with all the rain we've had. But I get to do all the things I love, you know, and it no day is the same. They're very full days. I cannot, as I said earlier, I don't live at the inn, so I get to do all the best parts, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We've been, you know, testing recipes for 20 years, and because I don't like to only rely on the recipes from the cookbooks. I just, you know, it's my thing to mm-hmm. to constantly be inquisitive, and so that's what I've been doing. And every now and then I get to walk on the beach.
It sounds like a wonderful life.
It's pretty good. I think in this economy I've declared that I might have to work until I'm 140, and that would be okay. Because
when you're doing what you love, it's great.
I'm doing what I love. Uh-huh. We get to travel as much as we want to, and it's not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad.
You have a website, and mm-hmm. you can sign up for the Inn's newsletter I saw on the website, and
yes.
you also can people can get signed cookbooks directly through the website. Is that right?
Yes, that's true.
Okay, well, I will be giving all that information to our listeners. And Julie Rosso, again, thank you so much. I'm honored and flattered and just thrilled to get to talk to you.
Oh, thank you very much. You made my day.
Great.
Thank
and
you.
I hope you have wonderfully red tomatoes really soon.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, babe, what's in your eyes? I saw them flashing like airplane lights. You fill my cup, babe, that's for sure.
Julie's website is easy to find. It is simply Julie Rosso. That's JulieRosso.com. Now, we revisit Mouthful's conversation with Sheila Lukens, who was in the midst of a rigorous book tour when she stopped by the studio early last December. Well, welcome to Mouthful, Sheila.
Hello. So happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I think we almost had you a couple of years ago.
Oh, with that Silver Palette 25th anniversary?
Yeah, I guess your co-author, Julie, did something terrible to her knee.
No, I think so. Something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, she ended up having surgery.
Yeah, yeah, I guess she did.
Yeah, but now it's a new book. You have written this. It is 10 by Sheila Lukens. So it's a no co-author on this one.
No, actually, most of my books since The New Basics was the last thing we ever did together.
Uh-huh.
And I did, after that, All Around the World and the USA Cookbook and Celebrate. And now this is
now
my
this
seventh
one.
Book.
You are really busy. This is like all of your other books. This has heft.
They all have some heft to them.
Yes.
And I think if we sell it by the pound, that 1995 just isn't bad these days.
No, that's a bargain.
Per pound. Yeah, right.
Well, the title is intriguing. 10, all the foods we love, and 10 recipes for each. Tell me about the genesis of the idea.
Okay, well, this is good. And I really want to clarify in case no one quite gets it and they don't have a table of contents in front of them. I was out to dinner with my editor, Suzanne Rafer, who has been with me since the beginning of the Silver Palette Cookbook, and Peter Workman, my wonderful publisher. And we were out to dinner, and it always goes around to talking about food because we always talk about all the food we love. And, of course, we were oohing and aahing about when we feel like a steak, and we were talking about all the cravings that people have and what we always crave. Well, you know, if it comes up on towards the warm weather, and even, you know, even in the cold weather, you just love a big, great, big, giant plate of lobster fradil of avolo or some yummy old broiled lobster or a lobster roll or a big, thick, juicy steak when you feel you need a little blood and your iron is low and you just want something like that. Mashed potatoes or other great mashes. And then we were talking about how much we love seasonal food, for instance. And then summer's going to be here soon. Or, for instance, got all those berries and local strawberries and local blueberries and blackberries. So they're the seasonal foods. Or, as I said, they're the craves, the real craves, or the foods that we're just so passionate about, like our passions, like chocolate or ice cream in the middle of the night. Or for some of us, it's spare ribs or baby backs and great barbecue sauce. And I must admit, I'm an aficionado of great barbecue sauce. I mean, I make delicious barbecue sauce. So I would say, you know, and you might think that's kind of snippy of me to say when there are all these great grill masters all over the place, but my barbecue sauce, I'd have to say, is pretty damn good. Excuse the word.
It's quite all
you
right.
You can believe me. But I'm telling you, and then, I mean, to say nothing of all the great greens. I mean, the greens out here, but we have greens on the East Coast, too. The farmers are so extraordinary these days. And so our farm stands and the farmers markets have the most beautiful things. So all the salads and the gorgeous leafy salads we have and our pies and, oh, I don't know, clams and shrimps. Well, we're talking about all these great foods. Well, Peter says that sounds like a book. All these great foods. And I said, oh, Peter. And he said, well, what about 10 recipes for each? Let's do a book.
Now, you mentioned a couple minutes ago, you mentioned microgreens.
Yes.
But I want you to talk about the fact that you didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. You have a lot of those new things that people are interested in, the newly available ingredients.
Yes.
However, you also have iceberg wedges with green goddess dressing.
Well, I'm telling
you,
I made my own
favorites.
Green goddess. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Because iceberg lettuce has resurfaced.
Yes, it has.
And it's resurfaced kind of like the darling of many chefs' meals. Now everybody eats salads. I tend to make my own salads. The other day, I was in a very high-class market, and I bought, like, you know, those hard plastic containers that, you know, the baby spinach is sold in. Well, I bought a hard plastic container filled with perfectly prepared butter lettuce. I mean, butter lettuce, so soft little leaves, gorgeous pale green leaves. So, I mean, it has really come a long way from those, you know, kind of soggy bags of mescaline in the supermarket. Now, this was in an upscale supermarket that I bought that butter lettuce. I couldn't wait to run and get it. It was gorgeous, and every leaf was perfect, and it lasted for a week in my refrigerator.
How did you approach getting the recipes? There's certainly a mix of what is obviously classic home cooking, but also you get some of the really famous specialties from various chefs. And we're here on the West Coast, so you've got Zuni roast chicken.
Oh, I asked her if I could have that recipe.
Okay, so you just went to them and asked for them,
Oh, yes. No, I didn't take them. Well, I love that recipe.
Everyone does.
I love that restaurant.
That's just that restaurant
that
and that recipe
just classic.
Is classic. Absolutely.
It's like the quintessential Zuni recipe, that chicken bread salad.
Now, talk about testing that. Is that something that you really feel people can do at their home and make it that delicious as it is at Zuni?
Well, you know, it depends. Mm-hmm. That, I will tell you, of all the recipes in the book, is not that easy a recipe to do. Mm-hmm. There are other chefs' recipes in my book. There's a Tom Colicchio rack of pork recipe, easy to do. I rewrote that recipe. Mm-hmm. He gave me his version of the recipe. I rewrote it. It's very easy to do the way I wrote it, and I retimed it, etc. There's a Tom Valenti duck in red wine. I rewrote that completely. But Judy's I pretty much left as is. Now, I had run that in Parade magazine once. I've been food editor of Parade magazine for 22 years. I wrote that and did it for Parade magazine once. It's not an easy, it's not a beginner's recipe, but you can do it.
You can do it. What made you decide on which recipes to include? Was it, I mean, I know that it was generated out of passion and the things you crave, but you have, for example, hula ribs.
That's all my recipes.
Okay, so they're the things that you really crave.
When I decided to do barbecue sauces and ribs, I sat down at a table for 6 months. I mean, 4 months, first of all, and outlined what the sections would be. Mm-hmm. Then within each section, I had to think of 10 and come up with 10 great recipes for each section. Mm-hmm. First of all, chicken, roasted chickens, because it's 10 recipes for roasted chicken, because that's a wonderful thing to do with chickens. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't going to throw any old chickens in there. I wanted 10 roasted chickens. I think the last thing I came up with to do, first of all, I figured out what I was going to do, what the 10 chickens were going to be, and what the 10 ribs were going to be before I even started.
Mm-hmm. Have you been cooking since you were a kid?
No.
So when did you start? Oh, okay. So you
I taught myself, and I'm not married now, but I taught myself how to cook when I got married.
And because you had to or because you really wanted to?
Okay. Anyone that gets married needs to get, and certainly then when I got married, you need to know how to cook.
Yeah. And so at what point did you decide, or maybe you didn't decide, maybe it just happened, to take it professional? I know you had the little silver palette shop.
It was before that. Okay. I was a caterer. For single men. And that's how I met Julie Rossa.
How does one become a caterer for single men?
I was home. I got married. I lived in London. I lived in Paris. But then when we moved back, I went back to school. Actually, I have my degree in art education from New York University. Mm-hmm. I'm an art teacher. But then I never did that. I did graphic design after that. Mm-hmm. And never made any money, but I was home. I had two babies. And so while I was home, I didn't want to work outside of the house. I wanted to be home with the girls. And I got a call one night from this guy that lived in my building. He was an investment banker, single. He said, help, Jill, I'm in trouble. I need help. Oh, my God, I'm having all these people over for dinner, and the superintendent and his wife are on vacation. She usually makes a lasagna for me. What am I going to do? Do you know anyone who can make dinner for me? I said, look, George, I'm home with the girls. I'll make dinner for you. So I did. I made dinner for him. And it happened that at the party, call me the next. Oh, at first I said, what are you going to pay me, George? We decided on $100 plus the cost of the food. It was for like six people. I said, that's great, George. I couldn't believe it. I was getting actual cash dollars. I was thrilled. But I worked all day. I made him a big Greek dinner, a little tarama, a little baba ganoush. I sent him some pita breads, a big Greek salad, and a moussaka. And then I think I went and got some baklava and sent that over with. So anyway, George was so excited. I said, I'll send it across the courtyard with the elevator man. And tomorrow you can return my dishes clean. And so the serving pans that I made everything in, sent it back with the money. I was so excited. Anyway, it happened that Gail Green was at that dinner. Oh. And also this other woman who writes for New York Magazine. This other woman as well, Joan Crone, who was a... she wrote a design column, like not interior design, more industrial design column for New York Magazine. So they both thought, oh, my God, Sheila did this. How cool. Sheila should have a catering business for single men. What a great idea. We want to write about it for New York Magazine. But what she really should do is go see Ellen Stern, who is doing Best Bets for New York Magazine then. And Ellen Stern was the best person to ever do Best Bets for New York Magazine. And that was in the early 70s, mid to early 70s. And she always had these funky headlines and everything. Anyway, she called me and said, look, she wanted to write about it, not the other girls, but she wanted me to come see her and to bring a picnic basket filled with any food I could make. She wanted to really taste my stuff and see what it was like. Maybe she'd write me up. And if you were written up by Best Bets in New York Magazine, yeah, then that
was huge.
Huge. So anyway, I brought up this picnic basket with salmon mousse, pâté maison, the little chicken liver pâté with currants, all kinds of stuff, chicken salad with walnuts and tarragon, all the stuff that I ultimately made for the Silver Palette.
Mm-hmm.
So brought it over there. I felt, you know, like Red Riding Hood with my picnic basket. Went over there. She loved everything. She said, I'm going to do a big piece on you. She did a full page on me for New York Magazine. And it was Eat, Drink, and Be Murray was the headline. And I became the other woman catering company. And I had my subhead was so discreet, so delicious, and I deliver. And I, you know, she photographed me in my kitchen with a huge platter of chicken marbella, which I used to make just like that because I made it. It was my, like, my dish that I made. I got 200 calls from single men in a couple weeks. I'm telling you, like the phone was ringing off the hook. And it wasn't like guys to go out with. It was guys primarily that had their own small businesses that wanted business catering done. And that's how
that's
I started.
How it also, that's a great
it was,
story.
It was. It was a great story. I could do it now. I might meet someone. Girls. Anyway, so I started, you know, and eventually, like 2 years later, I get this phone call. Hi, Sheila. My name is Julie Rosso. I'm blah, blah, blah's girlfriend. And I have been eating your food for 2 years, and I love it. I work for Burlington Domestics. That was the sheets and towels division of Burlington Industries. Mm-hmm. And we're releasing a new line of Ole Cassini sheets, and I'd love you to cater a press breakfast for me. And for the sheets, it's like a market week at Burlington.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I said, oh, would you do it? I said, yeah. That's how I met Julie Rosso. So.
Well, and what was that, what, the mid-70s?
Probably, I guess, end of 75.
Okay.
And so I did this press breakfast at Ole Cassini's house, which was in this area of New York called Murray Hill. Mm-hmm. Very fancy house, townhouse, with lots of armor in it, you know, like knight's armors, knight's clothes. And so I go in the house, but I decided to really wow her because it was like, you know, so good not to just be in my own house catering and sending this food out anonymously. So I hire cappuccino machines and espresso machines. I hired waiters. I got from Brooklyn this Fox's You Bet chocolate syrup. I got those turquoise seltzer bottles. I made 8 creams for the press with, you know what those are?
Yes, people. Definitely.
Even though you're in Northern California, you put milk and chocolate syrup and you put spritzy seltzer in them. Fabulous. 8 creams from New York. I made dessert mousses, kind of. I had lemon mousses. I had blackberry mousses. I wrapped ripe figs in prosciutto. This was, like, very wild. Oh, I had croissants, of course. And the press was not writing about the sheets, not one word, but they wrote about the food, like this food was amazing. They loved this. This was wild food. So Julie was, like, talking to me during this. I have this idea I'd like to talk to you about. Meantime, at this time, more and more women had gone back to work. Were going back to work. They were becoming lawyers. They were working in advertising. They were going to medical school. No women were barefoot, pregnant, and in the kitchen anymore. They needed places to stop on the way home from work, pick up dinner, or even a dinner party if they wanted. So this was a very interesting time. Well, she said, I want to open a shop where you could come get the best of everything in food. Now, that was her concept. She said, do you want to do it with me? She wanted to buy everything in, buy the best charcuterie, the best breads, the best cheeses, the best shelf items, etc. There was no talk about fresh food at that point. I really didn't know what I was getting myself in for. Do you want to do this with me? And I said, let me think about it. And she said, well, look, if not you, I'm going to do it with someone else. I said, I'm in. You know, that's it. And so we did it. And we looked for a place on the Upper East Side of New York, much too expensive. Then we looked on the Upper West Side of New York and this area called Columbus Avenue. And it was really a nasty area. It was very rough at that time, kind of thought of as Needle Park. It was rough. And there was one little place that I happened to love. It was not far from my home, which my home was on Central Park West, and it was a little nicer. But there was an 11x14 space, tiny, but it had this beautiful blue metal around the bottom and a great, like, window. It was a radio repair shop, $495 a month. So we took that space, got a great architect, and made the place beautiful. Mm-hmm. And we opened the Silver Palette in 1977. That was that.
And then how long was Silver Palette there?
Until we sold it in 88. Uh-huh. But that same year, in 77, we opened, Dean and DeLuca opened, Eli Zabar opened, and he had a shop on Madison Avenue and 81st Street. Now, it was really a seminal year for takeout food. I'm mm-hmm. not sure exactly when Irvine Ranch opened in Los Angeles. But I'm telling you, all of a sudden, takeout prepared
took
food
off.
Took off like crazy. Yeah. It was really exciting. And we did very well. We sold mm-hmm. out of everything from the second mm-hmm. we opened.
And when did you start having prepared foods? That
immediately. Because it turned out that that's all the people wanted. Uh-huh. And we opened in July 77th. There was a Philharmonic concert in the park.
So people wanted things they could just get any.
Immediately. They wanted. Yes. They ate everything. Uh-huh. They ate everything. We had to make everything every single day. And I was cooking everything in my apartment. Oh, my God. It was like a nightmare. But that was a block from the store. But eventually, we found a space to rent around the corner from a kitchen around the corner from the store. And we had to hire help and everything because otherwise it was just...
Yeah, it was really taken off.
Oh, my God.
And then the first book, the Silver Palette Cookbook.
1982.
Absolute classic.
We did, yes. Those were the recipes we cooked in the store.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that I think is interesting in cooking at the moment is since we've had this extreme economic downturn, I've noticed articles in major magazines, real mainstream publications, they're saying, oh, my goodness, people are figuring out that they can actually save money by cooking at home. Have you seen sort of this resurgence of interest?
Well,
I think, as you travel around the world, if you're really careful.
I did an article for Parade, Dinner for Four, under $25. Boy, that was really difficult to pull together, and I wasn't serving filet mignon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was hard.
But just that whole idea of people, for so long, people have thought that they were too busy to cook. But now they're finding out that, number one, it's a lot cheaper than buying packaged foods off the shelf, but also that it's a form of entertainment and pleasure in itself.
It is entertainment and pleasure, and it's nice to be able to spend time with your friends and, you know, just speak to each other, even your children. You know, spend a little time with your kids and speak and sit down and spend some quiet time together or some social time together.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And if you look around the supermarkets and, you know, compare some prices, you will find a place that's a comfortable place for you to shop in, I think.
So what's next for you? Do you know?
Oh, my God. Well, just to finish this book tour and have a nice holiday.
And then relax.
I mean, after I finished Thanksgiving, I left.
Yeah. And book tours are almost more grueling than the process of writing the book in a lot of ways.
Well, they are, especially cooking book tours.
Oh, yes.
Because you have to cook on television first thing in the morning. You give cooking classes all the way along. My fingers are really chopped up. I mean, no, they are. I've been giving cooking classes that go from 6 to 9:30 and, you know, like a few a week, and it's exhausting.
It's exhausting. How many cities do you know? Are you
20 covering? Cities.
20, yeah. That's a lot.
That's a lot. Absolutely.
When do you wrap up? In time to get home for Christmas?
I don't get home, I guess, until it's over the 19th.
The 19th. Okay. Not too. Okay. Well, I hope you have a really great holiday. And again, the book is 10 from Sheila Lukens, All the Foods We Love and 10 Recipes for Each. It is, of course, from Workman Publishing. And it is a bargain, $19.95.
Well, I thought so. And why I love giving books, they're so easy to wrap.
They are very easy to wrap as a gift.
You know, they're square, and it's great. And the corners, if you get wrapping paper that's not too thick, it folds. The corners do so nicely. And then you put a nice little bow on it. I just think they're the perfect gift. And
books,
remember
absolutely,
when you used to get books for presents? I remember when I was growing up, I used to be so excited to get a book for the holidays.
I agree. I still am.
Up in a corner and go start reading it immediately. So I think it makes a great gift.
Well, Sheila, thank you so much for stopping by Mouthful, and I hope the rest of the tour goes really smoothly and that you have a great holiday.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. This was fun.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad.
Well, it was great fun. Good to meet you all. I loved it. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You betcha.
Silver wings shining in the sunlight, roaring engines headed somewhere in flight. They're taking you away.
Thanks again for joining us. Be sure to tune in next week when we remember Julia Child and Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. And in the meantime, check out Mouthful's Facebook page, where you'll find a classic recipe from the Silver Palette Cookbook. It's Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. If you're a regular listener, become a fan. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Have a great week.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.